Welcome to the Plain Label Podcast, Pod Shots.
This is my jurisdiction. I want these men as much as Crazy does.
He'll deliver more justice in a weekend than 10 years of your courts and tribunals. Just stay out of his way.
I'd like to understand him. Give me that.
Peter Ramos.
What was she to Crazy then?
She showed him it was all right to live again. And they're gonna wish they never touched a hair on her head. A man can be an artist.
Anything, fool, whatever.
Creasy's art is dead. He's about to paint his masterpiece.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Podshots. I am your host, Eric Williams. For this episode, we are discussing the 2004 film Man on Fire, written by Brian Helgeland. The film was based on the book by A.J. Quinnell. The film was directed by Tony Scott and stars Denzel Washington, Dakota Fanning, Christopher Walken, and Radha Mitchell. Here to discuss the film with me is returning guest, Mr. Christopher Niesman.
Hey, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. Before getting into our discussion, I would like to mention that this podcast is brought to you by the Deliberate Noise Network. Head over to deliberatenoise.com and check out some of the other shows that are over there. So, Mr. Niesman, I'm stealing a direct segment from Around Comics and EOC. Drink roll call time. What do you have for me?
Let me see here. You knew I would be drinking if I was doing a podcast. I am drinking from the fine people over at Two Brothers Brewing Company, which is in Warrenville, Illinois. I'm having their Domaine du Page, which is their French style country ale.
Even though as
we talked a little bit before we started recording, we should both be drinking Jack Daniels and water.
That's right. And I was initially planning at least drinking some kind of whiskey. Jack and I aren't such good friends, but it, like I told Chris, it is too hot here in Lincoln, so I went with my more typical summer refreshing, and some may say a little on the feminine side, drink. And it is my, my Simply Grapefruit and my Pinnacle Vodka.
Grapefruit and vodka's fine. I would not call that a girly drink. I'd say it's a fine summer drink, sir.
It is very refreshing. It is very pink. And I don't care because I like it.
That's fine. You know, it's very funny, and obviously spoilers on this because we're actually going to talk about the movie. Apparently, we just have a thing about talking about movies where the main protagonist dies in a car ride at the end of movies.
That's the deal.
That's the ending of this movie is eerily similar to Payback, which was also one of my favorite movies, and the last time that that we talked.
That's true. That is very true. Apparently, I'm also apparently a big fan of Brian Helgeland because I have done. We just talked about Mystic River as of recording. We're doing murder mysteries on our regular themed based episodes, and I did Mystic River. I've done L.A. Confidential as a pod shots before. We've obviously, like you said, did Payback. So he's a writer that I, you know, didn't consciously know that I was such a big fan of, but apparently I am.
Yeah, that's right. Helgeland was involved with Payback.
Yes, he was.
That's right. It's a very, very few degrees of separation. I love that, you know, that Tony Scott directed this, because I think that he's one of the more underrated directors. Moment of silence for Tony Scott. People kind of pigeonholed him, I think, as just a straight action and kind of like cheesy popcorn action movie director.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. It was a popcorn action film director.
And to an extent, I guess that's kind of true, because he did do some really good popcorn action movies, but they're good popcorn action movies. And, sure. You know, and Man on Fire is probably my favorite movie that he's done. That was a big bummer whenever he passed away. That was earlier, was it 2 years ago? A year and a half ago?
Yeah, it was 2012.
Okay.
Yeah. So, not quite 2 years ago. It was in August.
But yeah. Since some of my favorite movies are Tony Scott movies.
Yes.
And I think he gets overshadowed by his probably more well-known brother, but,
I believe you are correct. All right. Well, before we're getting in, too far into it, we are now ready to discuss our 2004 film, Man on Fire.
There were 24 kidnappings in Mexico City in the last 6 days. Have you protected a lot of children before, Mr. Creasy?
I don't know. Bodyguards gotta be close to people. You know, I'm no good at that.
You're the silent type. People are gonna appreciate that.
16 years of military experience, extensive counter-terrorism work.
What happened to your hand?
It's a birth defect.
No, it's not.
No more questions. That's it. Period. You hear me?
Peter just wants to be friends.
I regret that your profession needs to exist.
So do I, Marjorie.
He's like a bear.
Yeah?
Big, sad bear. Good things happen too, Creasy.
Yeah? Like what?
Like meeting me. Creasy, you're smiling.
Pita! Pita! Run!
His art is death. He's about to paint his masterpiece.
And the plot synopsis over at IMDb is as follows. A wave of kidnappings has swept through Mexico, feeding a growing sense of panic among its wealthier citizens, especially parents. In one six-day period, there were 24 abductions, leading many to hire bodyguards for their children. Into this world enters John Creasy, a burned-out ex-CIA agent-slash-operative who has given up on life. Creasy's friend Rayburn brings him to Mexico City to be a bodyguard to 9-year-old Peter Ramos, a daughter of industrialist Samuel Ramos and his wife Lisa. Creasy is not interested in being a bodyguard at first, especially to a youngster, but for lack of something better to do, the plot synopsis says, he accepts the assignment. Creasy barely tolerates the precocious child and her pestering questions about him and his life, but slowly she chips away at his seemingly impenetrable exterior. His defenses drop and he opens up to her. Creasy's newfound purpose in life is shattered when PETA is kidnapped. Despite being seriously wounded during the kidnapping, he vows to kill anyone involved in or profiting from the kidnapping, and no one can stop him. So, Chris, this was a film that you brought to me after our payback discussion. You said, well, you know, I really like Man on Fire.
So, it is one of my favorite movies.
So if you feel like talking about that one,
yeah,
I'm up for that. And that was one of the things where I just coincidentally had happened to have that that Blu-ray on my shelf and unopened, and I was like, oh well, that's a nice excuse for me to talk about the film and to actually watch the movie, because you know how life gets in the way and sometimes you watch a film once or twice and then you don't really revisit it as much as maybe some others. So what is it, like, what's your history with this film? Did you go to the theaters? Did you just happen to catch it? Are you a big Denzel guy? Are you a big Tony Scott guy? Like, what is it that brought it to you?
Yeah, this was at a time when, you know, so it's 2003, yes?
2004.
Denzel was kind of at the height of his...
He was Denzel,
He was Denzel. He was one of the biggest leading men in Hollywood, and was on kind of a string of some strong movies at that time. I'm a big fan of Fallen. I think is one of his better movies. But Man on Fire came out.
Yeah,
and
he was really spitting them through here in the late the late 90s, early 2000s, because like you said, Fallen is 98, and he goes from that to He Got Game to The Siege to The Bone Collector, Hurricane, Remember the Titans, Training Day, John Q, Antoine Fisher, Out of Time, Man on Fire, Manchurian Candidate, Inside Man. You know, every year or every other year is just churning out films that, while they all may not be excellent, they are at least interesting, and he, you know, plays... He seems to play some characters that have flaws in them, and major flaws.
Oh, sure. Oh, Training Day. Training Day is great.
Yes, Training Day is great. He certainly likes to play a type, and at this, he was really on a roll here in this point of his career.
And this movie comes out, and it is not made by the Mexican Tourism Board, by the way.
Oh my God, is it not?
this is what I describe as the you don't ever want to live in Mexico movie.
Yeah,
it's really funny because when it goes to the credits, the first thing is thank you for to the people of Mexico City, you're amazing, or it's an amazing place, or something like that.
A truly
special place. And I guess it's truly special. It is not a Mexico tourism video at all. It's does not show Mexico in the best light. But that was also something that was a huge problem, still is a huge problem, is the kidnappings in Mexico. It is a freaking industry down there. But what I love about the movie is that it taps into what your most primal revenge instincts. It's like when, you know, those, your revenge fantasies that I think everyone has at some point or another. It's like, you know, to see someone do some horrible, nasty thing, and you're like, oh, I want to see them suffer. And this movie taps into that. And not saying that is a good thing to fantasize about, or, sure, you know, or a good outcome, but it does tap into that feeling. And Denzel plays that role so well. And the probably two or three, you know, favorite scenes in the movie, but there's the scene with Christopher Walken talking to the, with the former Interpol, agent. He's the, oh gosh, what?
Yeah, Giancarlo Giannini is who it is, but he plays Miguel Manzano.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, I forget what law enforcement is he a part of. It's kind of like
it's called the AFI. I'm not sure what that.
It's kind of like their FBI, because local law enforcement in this, local police are corrupt and crooked, and so I think this is like the next level. It looks like an FBI type guy. But Walken is talking about Creasy, and I love that whole interaction where he's talking about artists, and it's like, there are artists in anything. You have, you know, people that can be artists with food, or, you know, artists with a brush. John Creasy's art is death. and he's getting ready to paint his masterpiece. Yes. And that is so one of my favorite lines in this movie. And that's, you have this huge setup. I mean, the, like half the movie is this, this redemption story about this person who is, you know, running from, you know, his past and running from God and, you know, really just kind of playing out the string until he dies. And he's a raging alcoholic and has done some horrible, nasty, he was an assassin for the CIA. And so you have half of this movie is the redemption of this man as he finds a reason to live again. And it's the relationship that he develops with this young girl that he's the bodyguard for. And when that's taken away, so is his reason to live life again. And then he does the only thing that he's really good at, and that is kill people. Sure. And it's amazing how efficient and brutal he is at it.
Yes, he is. I'll get into my history real quick before I comment on that. But I saw this, you know, it's one of those where I see Denzel on the cover of a movie and I'm very apt to see it, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, well, I'll give it a shot. You know, even the remake of Pelham 123, like, oh, okay, I'll give it a go. And so I remember seeing
another
Tony Scott film. I remember seeing this on, you know, DVD and just kind of giving it a go, and you know, Man on Fire. I remember seeing the trailer. I remember the line that you had just quoted from Walken. And so I was like, okay, well, it's going to be a revenge movie. And I found that it was a revenge movie, but there was a lot more to it. Mm-hmm. And so I really appreciated that. And then I had kind of put it away for a little while. And, you know, like I said, I bought the Blu-ray and we had talked about watching it. And since then, I mean, people that are very close to me know that there's been a lot of changes going on. And so now I have a 5-year-old. I have a 5-year-old daughter, mm-hmm. that I live with. And my view of the film is a little bit different now.
Sure, sure.
And, you know, you watch it and it's talking about all these kidnappings and I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. You know, this isn't going to be a big deal. And then when you start witnessing their relationship to where he's the surrogate father to her.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's similar to my situation where
you would cut off a man's fingers if they hurt your 5-year-old.
That's right. I would use cigar lighters from cars or cigarette lighters. I'd do all kinds of stuff. And so what I'm getting around to is that, you know, it hit me a lot harder this time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really appreciated that. But what I wanted to mention about Tony Scott was I like that. You know, I think that he's known for his kinetic camera and his color choice, mm-hmm. and kind of the unpredictability of it all, at least his more recent films or his later films. I don't know that they had the same sort of quality in Top Gun, say, in the 80s,
I don't think so. Yeah. I don't believe so.
Sure. And so what I think that works so well here is he has this real kinetic camera and it is able to show mental instability and addiction very well.
And just the uncertainty, mm-hmm. of scenes, you know, the rapid camera movement, how bleached out it is. You get the feeling of how hot Mexico is, and just how it's shot to make you feel very uncomfortable and disoriented. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever been to Mexico, you can become very, very hot and disoriented very easily. And so I felt like this was shot in a way that fit the location exactly. And like you said, he's an alcoholic, mm-hmm. and there are scenes where he is disoriented and it's shot to kind of capitalize on that.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, it made me feel like it was like someone having a heat stroke almost was the way that it was filmed. Yeah. You know, because it makes you sweaty watching it, but it also makes you like, oh my God, it's so hot. I'm disoriented all the time. And now I'm just going to down this bottle of Jack while I'm at it, you know? And, so I guess my first sort of question, and some of these are fairly easy to answer, I think, but, you know, Creasy is there with Ray, and then later they call him Rayburn, but it's, Christopher Walken's character, and he's there essentially to say goodbye, right? Like, isn't that what you...
He's really lost. Yes. Yeah. He's played out at that point. I think he's killed so many people and done so many things in his life that I don't even know if it's a guilt that he has or just like this loss sense of self. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he has the conversation with Rayburn is God ever going to forgive us for what we've done? And Rayburn's like, I don't think forgiveness is in the cards for us. So, sure. I mean, they've done some pretty, pretty nasty things. Yeah, but yeah, I think he's ready to not be alive anymore.
Right. Yeah. For me, he's saying his final goodbye to his friend and mm-hmm. potentially one of his only friends, you know?
Yes.
And what I love about that is, I think that that's very interesting. I do think that you can see that in some other films, but what I like about this particular version is later when Rayburn is with his wife and you see PETA there and they're talking about, oh, you know, we were going to go off and rule the world. And then he fell in love and then he mentions a woman's name.
Yes.
But that's all that you get. Mm-hmm. And they kind of look like, oh man, that was a bad situation. So you don't know if he messed things up, if she got killed, if he just couldn't handle this, you know, being in a relationship. You don't know anything about it. And I love that it just gives that little extra bit of history with the character.
Yeah, that scene I think was also important because it set up the relationship with Rayburn and PETA where it was important to him as well. And you needed that later after she was abducted that Rayburn needed to care about this, not just for his friend, but for her. And so, but that and just seeing Walken on screen in any scene is great. But I did like that scene at the restaurant.
Sure.
It was, I think, very, very important. And you know, the entire first half of this movie, it's like coming in, you know what's going to happen.
Right.
You know she's going to get abducted. And so it's this entire build up to an event that you know is going to happen. And so you're just waiting for it the entire movie. Did you like that? Were you, obviously you knew, you know what this movie is before you, sure. before you get into it. I mean, all of the foreshadowing is there. If she doesn't get abducted, then it's the worst movie ever. You know,
it's a bait and switch then. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, what did you think about the build up to the abduction and how they developed that relationship between PETA and Creasy?
I really liked it because I think that while I knew that it was there in the back of my mind, I was so sucked into their relationship, especially this time. Like, this time I intellectually know what's happening, you know? Mm-hmm. But I was so into this new parent, essentially, into this young girl's life and how he's dealing with her and how he's trying to make her a better person. And then as soon as they're both on the same page, finally, then she's taken.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, the destination is known, but the way that they get to it is more interesting than most films, because I think most films, like you mentioned earlier, would have had it happen in maybe the first 20 minutes as opposed to the, at the hour mark, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there's really not a whole lot that, I mean, you can say that this is a revenge action adventure movie. Not really. I mean, it is for the last hour, but the build up, there's not, it's very much a character movie.
Sure.
You know, almost to the point that there are a few things that are a little ham-fisted. You know, it's like whenever they're at the swim meet and he's talking to the nun and says, oh, you know, her parents are out of town.
Oh, yes.
And she's like, well, today you are her father.
Yes.
And I'm like, oh, God. Okay. Lay it on a little bit thicker, you know.
I did like, however, their first conversation where she starts trying to say, you know, to lecture him. mm-hmm. essentially, and he, you know, finishes the quotation from the Bible on her.
Mm-hmm.
And she's kind of like, ooh, okay. Because I do like that, and I think that it's interesting that they chose Mexico City for this, with the Catholic guilt and with the, you know, Catholicism and family, and nothing's more important than family, and then choose to have all this kidnapping. I think that, you know, that's a perfect setting for the story.
Oh yeah. And that shit happens in Mexico City.
Sure.
You know, Mexico City, I don't know if you've ever been there. It is huge. It is what it is, like 17 million people or something. It is a gigantic city. It's cities within cities. It is so big. We haven't mentioned whenever you went through the cast. I think it's very, was this Mark Anthony's acting debut?
You know, I believe it was. I do have a note about him. What did you think of Mark? What did you think of Mr. Jennifer Lopez or Mr. X Jennifer Lopez? Whatever it is now, I guess I don't even know.
If you didn't know who he was coming, and I'm not a pop music fan, you know, like top 40 pop music fan. And so I have very little, knowledge of Mark Anthony. I felt like as an actor, he was a little miscast. Mm. He's, to me anyway, not the most attractive man.
No, and he's funny looking. For sure.
He is kind of funny looking. And he is one of the more out of place actors in the movie. And I would have preferred to have seen someone else, but you know, I think having the cachet of Mark Anthony, you're going to get Mark Anthony fans to go and see this movie. He was fine. And it did lead to, you know, yeah, another one of my favorite scenes whenever he comes to his end, it shows that Creasy has so many different ways to kill people.
Giving the bullet thing,
yeah,
yes.
Even in making them kill themselves. Yes. And I thought that was a pretty awesome scene. If more for Denzel than Mark Anthony.
Yeah. This was his 11th of 13 credits as an actor.
Okay. Okay. So he's
done some things. I don't think he's had much in terms of roles that I'm familiar with. He was in Carlito's Way, but his character is listed as Latin band at disco. So he plays awesome. Like, you know, singer.
It's like Madonna in Vision Quest.
Sure. So yeah, I saw him on there, and I remember the first time seeing him going, ooh, wow, what is he doing in here?
Yeah.
Because this, you know, Denzel is a different type of actor to have someone like Mark Anthony in here, I felt like. Like, this is not the picture to have him in. I think this time watching it, I feel like I maybe understood it a little bit more, because I think Rada Mitchell's character is supposed to be so domineering and actually the one in charge.
Yes.
And so you have to have a weaker male. And who better than Mark Anthony? I mean, no, I don't think anyone really thought in the celebrity world that, you know, that when him and Jennifer Lopez were married, it's like, oh, Jennifer Lopez is married to this guy?
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, and he's the lesser star, at least in the U.S. So it makes sense to me in that respect, but at the same time, he's not particularly good. And I also had a little bit of problems with her too. Like,
she was fine. I like her in this movie.
I think she's good. I don't know if I liked the Southern accent that came out a little more.
Yeah, it's, well, I mean, it kind of gives you it's the story that they don't ever say, is that she was a really pretty woman from the South in America who fell in love with a rich Mexican industrialist. And, you know, she talks about, you know, going to clubs and being selfish. And there was this party life that they led. And then she had a child, and it's, yeah, you know, I didn't have a problem with the accent. The only problem I had with the accent is that it wasn't consistent.
Right, exactly. Yes.
So, yeah.
It would kind of come and go a little bit, but.
Yeah. But yeah, as someone that grew up in Southern Illinois, my accent will come and go from time to time. So it's actually not that inaccurate.
Sure. Yeah,
I get another Domaine DuPage in me, and we'll be talking yuns and you alls here in a little bit.
Well,
I like her another. I loved her in Pitch Black. Hmm. I don't know if you've seen Pitch Black, right?
Yeah. That was my introduction to Mr. Diesel.
Ah, okay, nice. But yeah, I've liked her in a few things.
Yeah.
But I think that she's pretty convincing as the mom in this. I don't know if I could buy Dakota Fanning being Mark Antony's daughter, though.
right. That's the one where it's like, well, you have to have a good child actor, so what are you going to do?
Yes, we adopted this beautiful Swedish child.
That's right.
She is the whitest of white girls.
Yes, she is. What do you think of the fact that when Creasy first gets that position, mm-hmm. speaking of Lisa, and he's sort of greeted as, oh, you're an American, you know, and she's very excited about that. Do you think that it's because of American, or do you think that race has a factor in there? Do you think it's like, oh, he's kind of intimidating looking because he's a black man, so I think that'll be a good bodyguard as well. So do you think that played into anything as far as she may think?
I don't know if his race really played into it as much as, you know, I think the American thing was interesting because she's half Mexican, half American. And I think that was a connection point. Mm-hmm. That she could share with him is, you know, because she lives there. That's her home, but she's from this other place. And I think that was the beginning of a connection, is that he was an American and she probably didn't spend that much time with other Americans outside of her mom. So I think that was, you know, probably a connection there. But no, his race, I don't think, you know, that's one thing in the movie. I don't think that his race really ever played a role. She did ask him that question.
Right.
So she brought it up and, you know, he was pretty dismissive about it. And I think for a reason, it's like, no, not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. One more thing about Lisa is, according to IMDb trivia, which, you know, it's a little dubious as to, it's kind of like Wikipedia, like, well, how much of it is actually true, but one of the little trivia bits is two sex scenes were filmed, but then cut from the film. And one was between Lisa and her husband, and one was between Creasy and her and Lisa.
Ah, you know, it's that is very interesting because you feel that sexual tension with them.
Yeah, I feel it more from her end than I do from him because I feel like he's got such a mess of a head. As it is,
mm-hmm.
I think that he looks at her, but I think that he looks at her much like many men would look at any attractive woman. But I feel like she's kind of like, Denzel, you know.
Nice.
But I thought
I can see that as it would have been interesting to find out where in the timeline of the movie that would have happened.
Sure. Yeah, I would imagine, you know, the scene that I get the biggest sense of it is when she goes in and she's got the big high heels and the black dress on and, mm-hmm. and, PETA is saying, you know, what about, do you have a girlfriend? And he says, you know, that's ancient history.
Nunya. That's Nunya.
Yeah. What was her name? Nunya Business. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So I think that may have been close to the area, I would guess, like maybe just a bit after that. But these are all things in the first half, and you know, one of the other things that I was just kind of writing down questions while I'm watching the film, and I had known that Mark Antony's character was behind it,
mm-hmm.
but I was, you know, she gets taken, and I'm like, well, how important is your business compared to your child, your offspring? And mm-hmm. it's like, why stay here? You know, that, like you mentioned earlier, this isn't exactly a pamphlet for please visit Mexico City.
Yeah.
I was like, well, what the hell? Like, can't you go somewhere, anywhere else? And then it's like, well, how self-centered are you that you're staying in this place with your child so directly in danger? Those are the questions, like, you know, obviously that I'm asking myself more and more when I'm watching films.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh my God, just protect your child. What are you doing? You know?
Well, I mean, there's always going to be danger, but you know, that was her thing, is that she was very insistent on getting a bodyguard.
Mm-hmm.
And, the Samuel Ramos character, you know, you said was, that's Mark Anthony's character,
sure,
was responsible for it. It was actually more Mickey Rourke. It was the lawyer that set this up. And this is, I think, we haven't even mentioned Mickey Rourke. I think one of the, more understated roles that Mickey Rourke has had, but is very good as the really kind of, you know, seedy, greasy lawyer for this family.
Sure, yeah, because, you know, he had come to prominence, you know, in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
Oh, yeah. We all watched 9 and a Half Weeks.
And then had sort of, you know, gone away a bit. And then...
became a boxer.
Sure, and then you know, what did Once Upon a Time in Mexico, and then this, and then Sin City, and Domino, and then, you know, eventually The Wrestler, which I think a lot of people would cite as, if not his best, but one of his best performances.
Oh, it's his best.
It's actually
a really good movie.
Yeah, it's really good, actually, yeah. But yeah, Mickey Rourke, you know, he's very not Mickey Rourke in this.
No, you know? Not at all.
So that is nice to see. It's nice to see him doing something a little different.
Yeah. I mean, did he get, was he totally beheaded in this?
I don't know. I think that, I mean, he was clearly killed. I don't remember.
Yeah.
I don't remember if he was beheaded.
That looks like a headless body floating in that pool.
Yeah, it definitely was.
He just took his fucking hat off. And it was actually, Mark Anthony's character that had him killed.
Yeah. Right.
So.
That's what happens. What a mess. What a mess it ends up being.
Oh, it's some, yeah, there's a big body count in this movie.
That's right. So we finally have the actual abduction go down, the kidnapping.
Great scene, by the way.
Yes, it is. That's what I wanted to mention is I love that, you know, Tony Scott gets attention for the bright colors and the crazy camera, but I love the choice to remove almost all of the sound during that sequence, you know, to where he's very particular on what sounds are audible and what isn't. And I think that works very well. I think that if it's just a, you know, it's just a typical scene, it's still impactful, but it doesn't quite have the weight that it does the way that it is displayed in the film.
Yeah. Yeah. It's shot so well. And mm-hmm. the pacing, it's all in slow motion. And you just, it's probably what I'd say 20 seconds of real time action, and it just gets drawn out and you see all of these moving parts and Denzel being a badass, but you know, in the face of insurmountable odds. And yeah, it's a great scene.
Yeah, it is. We have then, you know, she's obviously taken. Creasy's almost killed, and then we have what I wrote in the notes here was he essentially has his Punisher moment then.
Yes.
You know, he's reawakened, he's told what's happened. He, you know, he would typically have like this gritted teeth and determined look, and it's like, well, you know, now he's gonna go get his kind of a thing. And I think that you know, I refer to this film sometimes to some people as the Punisher movie that never was, because it could be that story.
Uh-huh, yeah. Oh, it's totally a Punisher movie.
You know, and if it was like a one-off, this would be the story, but, you know, if it has to be a continuing, reoccurring character, you have to find reasons for them not to be like this. But it's, you know, the characters are fairly similar with, you know, that I've done a lot of bad things and now I'm back in the real world and people close to me are killed or kidnapped and now I need to kill them all.
Well, you know, it's the scene once again with Walken and the agent.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that, you know, Creasy is going to meter out more justice in the next few days than your entire judicial and you know, law enforcement system could in years.
Yeah.
And that's a very Punisher, you know, type attitude. It's like, you know what? He's going to deal out punishment. And mm-hmm. that's what he does. So.
Yeah. One of my other favorite lines is when, Denzel says this and he's getting ready to blow up an SUV, I believe it is.
With a fucking with a rocket launcher.
Yeah. Jeez. And he says, they talk about forgiveness, and he says, forgiveness is between them and God. My job is to arrange the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I really like that. I think that's very well done, well said. One of the other things, before I get too far away from Tony Scott, that I really liked is I love how the subtitles are used in the film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, earlier in this year, another friend of mine, another Chicagoan actually, and I discussed Fruitvale Station. And on that film, they used text messages, much like they do the Spanish language subtitles.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Where it shows up on screen in a different way than you would expect. And you're like, oh, okay, that's interesting. Because in this film, you know, when they're screaming, it's all in caps. You know, the subtitles kind of move around a little 3D sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
When
it's almost like what they've done in Sherlock.
Sure. Yes. Yeah. Exactly right. And so when they, you know, when Rhoda Mitchell is talking to Mark Anthony's character, you know, she's got kind of subtitles that look a little sadder. You know, like they stream up like a tear, and they leave a little trail almost, and you know, they kind of evoke a bit of emotion, and I think that's a nice choice. It's not just a Star Wars-esque yellow words on a black screen kind of a thing, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think that's just another little bit that I think that works really well. So getting into the sort of revenge aspect of it, I do want to mention that this film, surprisingly to me. But the film, you know, made a good amount of money. It made almost $78 million and 130 worldwide. But on Rotten Tomatoes, which is becoming more and more of a look and see how it did kind of a site, but it only got 39% for positive reviews based from critics.
Really?
And the main complaint was that a lot of critics felt like Creasy was taking sadistic pleasure in the killings, since sometimes he gets no information from the deaths, and he's just killing everyone involved and yada, yada, yada. And I could not disagree more. Like, I felt like he wasn't enjoying himself.
No.
He was, you know, doing the David Mamet thing, just, you know, you get to watch a character do what they're good at. And yeah. He just has that sort of inner self-confidence of he knows what he's doing now. He knows how to get what he wants. He knows how to inflict pain where he wants and how he wants. And so I think that's kind of a shame that it's got such a low rating.
Well, yeah, and I don't think that's a justified criticism. You don't see him draw sadistic pleasure for doing that. He's on a mission to make the people that killed this little girl pay. And I don't think that there's any pleasure in that. He would, you see whenever he finds out that she's alive, you see his outlook completely change.
Yes. Yes.
And it's not about making them pay. It's about making her safe now, even if it costs him his own life. And so, no, I don't think that there was a sadistic pleasure that he had in killing these people. I think he was just very fucking good at it.
Yeah. And I do love the deliberate nature of most of the deaths too. It wasn't, I feel like that may have been part of the problem, to where I think a lot of people confuse him being deliberate with him enjoying what he's doing. Because specifically the cutting off the fingers, in the
car. Well, he was getting information there.
Sure, sure.
That wasn't sadistic pleasure. That was, you are going to tell me what I need to know, and then you're going to die. Mm-hmm. And that's how that went down. He's like, okay, my friend, time for you to go on to the next world.
Yes.
And he didn't waste any time there. And he didn't draw out the torture. He didn't have sadistic pleasure in it. He got his information. He cut the dude's fingers off and sealed them, burned them shut with a cigar lighter, and then he shot him in the head. And it was horrible, brutal. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was a brutal killing, but he got the information that took him to the next rung up the ladder.
Right.
And that's, and he follows that.
Much like the bomb implanted in the guy.
Yeah, that was awesome.
And that was the point that reminded me the most of Payback, because that was a little more heightened than a lot of the film, I guess. And like the walking away while stuff's blowing up behind you, you know, and all that kind of stuff. He seemed the most, you know, of a cool character there, you know, because he's like, you know, you have one last, he's like, you know what I wish, or, you know, I wish that you had more time. Something like that is what he says.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of
thing. That was once again, another great scene. And you shove a wad of C4 up someone's ass and have it connected to a pager detonator. And that was awesome. You know, but you know, all of these people deserve to die.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of them. Mm-hmm. Every one of them. And, you know, but he lets one go. And, you know, the woman from the nightclub.
Oh, right, right.
You know, he's like, if you tell me this, I'll let you live. And he let her live. So yeah, there was, you know, he could have easily have, you know, left her in that place to blow up. You know, but he didn't.
Sure. You know, one of the things that I found myself asking is, And one of the things that I've been on record on almost every show I feel like that I do is that I love the sort of downturn endings. I really have a problem with the sort of, the little red ribbon and the bow around films.
Oh, the Steven Spielberg ending.
Yeah. Yeah. To where, have you seen the film End of Watch with Jake Gyllenhaal? Okay.
Oh, no, yeah.
So the, without giving away spoilers, the film ends on a somber note.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have an additional scene where it says, oh, earlier in the day. And then it has the two characters like yucking it up and joking. And so that's what you walk away with.
Okay.
Is that you walk away with this positive, like, oh, but they were having fun. You know, you don't walk away with the, oh man, that's fucked up. Like, mm-hmm. you know, that was a messed up way to end the film. And so I'm so glad that this film doesn't do something like that, because I would sit and think, you know, once we get towards the end of the film, I'm like, well, what is it that Creasy would even do if he survived this? Like, what would his purpose be now?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and he has no purpose other than getting this girl back.
And that's, you know, that this movie was about him finding redemption, and he finds it in the end, and, you know, trades his life for one that is, you know, better, you know, quite frankly.
Sure.
And, you know, I mentioned it at the top of the show. I love the parallel in Indians between this and Payback, that you have, you know, the protagonist is, you know, not declared dead, but is pretty obviously, you know, on his way out the door, as the, you know, as the credits start to roll. And, you know, in this, not so much in Payback, but in this, I mean, his story was done. He was kind of living on borrowed time, which we haven't even talked about that. You know, he tries to kill himself.
Yes.
Relatively early in the movie, and doesn't die, mostly because of, you know, divine intervention, whatever you want to call it. But he's living on borrowed time kind of from, you know, that point on, and you're just waiting for him to die.
Yeah. You know, I do think that that scene is really well done. I really like, I think that something that's very difficult to play is a convincing drunk.
Yes.
I mean, you and I have both been very drunk.
Right? Yes, yes, obviously.
And so I think that if you're sober, trying to pretend like that would be very difficult. So I don't know the circumstance, whether they're like, here, Denzel, like, why don't you get a little ready for the scene kind of a thing. But I love the trying to catch the bullet. I love, like, one of my favorite things sometimes in films are the scenes that aren't there. And what I love about the scene that isn't there in this is like he's the Punisher type character, and now he unloads a bullet and he catches it, and then he goes off and kicks some ass or something, you know, something that would be very cliche. Like, he couldn't do it before, but now that he has a purpose, he's going to be able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just glad that something like that wasn't in the film.
Yeah.
And I love how he is in that sequence where he attempts to kill himself. He's shirtless, adding into the whole heat and the sweaty nature of the film. I like that he's just gulping down the Jack at this point, because, you know, people of a certain age will know that once you get drunk, you just, you know, can drink whatever and just not worry about it whatsoever. I like that he is not particularly in the best shape that Denzel's ever been in. I like that he's got a little belly to him.
Yeah, no, he's an out of work CIA assassin, mm-hmm. and doesn't have any purpose in his life, and he's a drunk, and yeah, and I love in the first couple scenes with him, you know, he's got the scraggly beard, and he just looks like he's been run hard and hung up wet, and you know, and you see whenever he gets the job, it's like, okay, now he's, you know, he's clean shaven, he's, you know, more professional, but there's still that kind of air of desperation about him.
Yeah. And so finally, what I really like is when he, towards the end of the film, when he's getting very upset, I think Denzel plays upset very well. You know, he plays angry, mm-hmm. and he has this sort of, you know, I was just writing things down, and he's just, I put unfucking hinged.
Yes.
So he's just, you know, animalistic. He's just, he's got anger and power, and he's just very raw. And that's a very scary combination for someone in his profession.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not only for everyone around him, but for himself, because he could easily make mistakes. You know, and I do like that, you know, I did mention that I don't really like films that put little bows around them, but I do like that PETA made it. You know, they gave you that, because the film could have been super dark and not a good time, you know?
Yeah. She has to make it for the movie to have its ending, because it's that is the key to his redemption, is that, and that very literal exchange of his life for hers.
Right.
You know, and that's your payoff for everything that he's, you know, gone through up to this point. So mm-hmm.
And we do have a few, we have a few different reveals, which I think are particularly good. One that you had sort of mentioned earlier, when they're at the club and they have the, do you want the girl
mm-hmm.
reveal? And at that moment, you're like, oh, okay, of course Pete is not dead. And then it's not her. And you're like,
yeah,
oh shit. Well, maybe she is dead. Like, you know, it keeps you a little bit off balance, and so I liked that. And then, of course, I love the actual reveal at the end and the whole Creasy Bear phone call, and I love the way that that's filmed, mm-hmm. where it's, you know, you can see it so clearly on his face, where he's hurt again by the fact that she is out there and he's got to find a way to get her.
Yeah.
And to get her back. So yeah, I really like that. I like the end sequence in particular as well, because we have the end and they have the bridge, and, you know, it's trading one for one, and he has the little scope on him with the, mm-hmm. the red dot. And, you know, this was a sequence that I didn't particularly remember, and I was like, oh, they don't actually, like, kill him, do they? And I loved that he gets near them and is not shot when he has the scope on him. And he gets near the people, and he immediately drops to his knees.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had enough. I'm done. I just want to be put down. You know, and I love that because it's him being able to step outside of himself and realize, look, I've done one good thing finally. Now is my time to go. You know,
yeah, who the hell was it that shot him? Was it the brother or the?
It's the brother who gets his fingers shot off.
Yeah. It's just fucking a hand shot off.
Yeah. He shoots him in that apartment.
Yeah.
And what I think is so weird, it's all like, that's when it's like Denzel the Terminator, because he gets shot in the chest a few times and it's just.
How many chest shots does that man take in this movie? Seriously, he gets shot in the fucking chest 3 times in this movie.
Yeah. It's like Denzel, there's vests, buddy. Like,
yeah. Yeah. And he's just kind of, he looks at it. It's like, eh. Yeah. I'm just like, no, you should be dead. So yeah, I mean, it's the kill shot, but you know, he's moving around for another 6 hours.
Yeah, you can just shake that off. But then once you're,
pure adrenaline, man.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's supposedly adrenaline or you know, it's just he's got this mission and he's so one of one mind to where he, once he finally finishes it, then he allows himself to expire. You know, and I can get that somewhat because I know that you are, have done the running. You're a runner. I know that, you know, I've done two half marathons, and there'll be times where I'll feel a little something mid-run.
You'll pray for death.
Right. You'll be on your knees going, oh,
just shoot me. Just shoot me.
Just put me on. What am I doing this for? Oh, shit. But you know, you'll feel something mid run and you'll be like, oh, well, I'm all right. And then as soon as you're done, you're like, oh my God,
I'm hurt.
Yeah, I am hurt. Somebody come help me. I need a banana. I need someone to help me walk out of here, you know, that sort of thing. So I guess I can see that in some respect, but it's like, geez, in the lungs twice or 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
That was a little much for me. I figured maybe he'd have a vest and that's why he was shaking it off. But no, he doesn't. I guess wrapping us up here, one of the things that I also did find was that A.J. Quinnell, like I said, the writer of the book that this film and the original version of this, which I was in a panic, like I told you about, like, oh shit, we're not talking about that one, are we? But it was a 1987 film that Scott Glenn was in.
Yes.
Also Man on Fire. And
which I have not seen.
I have not seen that either. But on this version, the writer of the novel, he really enjoyed this adaptation because it used a lot of the lines from the books. And you know, he said that, one of my favorite quotes about what he said was here. He says, when I first heard Denzel was playing the part of Creasy, I missed a couple of heartbeats, but he played the part brilliantly. The film is violent. And if the anger is not portrayed properly, the result can be awful. And mm-hmm. So I think that that's, you know, I think that ultimately the character is a solid character, but I think that Denzel's performance kind of raises it a little bit above what may be just on the page.
Yeah, and kind of going back to the criticisms, it's his cold professionalism about it that makes the character. So he's obviously someone who has been around. He's seen and done horrible, horrible things, and so it's not a shock or, you know, or joy in doing it. He's doing a job, and it's yeah, his anger is like this smoldering anger, mm-hmm. Right. You know, which I, yeah.
Love it.
It's, yeah. That's why it's one of my favorite Denzel roles.
That's true. Well, Chris, do you have anything else that we missed that you wanted to mention before we wrap this one up?
No, I need to find another movie where the protagonist is dying in a car in the last scene for our next movie to talk
about.
That's
true. That's true. All right. Well, if you know that film, You could email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. Also, if you have any other comments or suggestions or movies that you'd like to hear us talk about, you could get a hold of me there. You could also follow the show over at Twitter under the handle @plainlabelpod, where you could follow me. I'm @ericwilliams79. We also have a Facebook page for the show. You can like it. Just search for Plain Label Podcast. And if you like what we do here, you could help us out by going over to our website, which is plainlabelpodcast.tumblr.com, and clicking on the Amazon ad over on the right-hand side. If you click on that Amazon box, it takes you to their homepage. And what I want you to do is bookmark that homepage and then use it whenever you're buying anything, such as maybe rocket launchers, maybe Man on Fire if you don't want to get in trouble, maybe some Jack Daniels, something like that. So it doesn't change anything for you. It just helps us out and gives us a little bit of the cut. So I want to thank Chris for once again coming on and talking about the film with me. If people wanted to hear more from you or get in contact with you, where could they do so these days, Mr. Niesman?
At C. Niesman on Twitter, even though I'm not on Twitter that much. The Facebooks, the Twitter.
Facebooks and the Twitters.
Yeah, you know, your local bar.
If you're in Chicago, look for someone maybe in a Cardinals jersey, and it could be Chris.
Yeah, could be. You know, 5 a.m. running with the dogs, you know, something like that.
There you go. Yeah, if you see some dogs and a guy running with maybe a Cardinals jersey on still.
It could be
him. All right, well, thank you for listening, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with another co-host and another film.
So bad, I got a worried mind. I'm so lonesome all the time. Since I left my baby behind on Blue Bayou, saving nickels, saving dimes, working till the sun don't shine. Looking forward to happier times on Blue Bayou. Fishing.